This is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the gifts, a major gift that comes from an experience like cancer.
And it's a gift even if you don't have cancer, right?
Yes, it is. Oh, you got it. This book that I wrote is not a book simply for cancer patients. And
right.
Many people who are reviewing it are telling me, and I know it, that this book is a book about wellness.
Right.
How do you stay well? It's the secrets to staying well.
Exactly. So if people, just because we're running out of time, Susan, if people want to be in touch with you and would like more information and buy your book, could you let our listeners know where they could go?
Yes. To buy the book, go to Amazon, please. There's a beautiful workbook I created for it to make it personal. And I have a website. It's called An Inside Job, but we added the words, it's An Inside Job for Healing Cancer.com, and that's how they can contact me.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Susan Apollon, the author of An Inside Job, a psychologist shares healing wisdom for your cancer journey. Thank you so much, Susan, for being with us this morning on Health Watch.
Well, thank you for asking me. I'm so grateful. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm Ellen Goldsmith, licensed acupuncturist, your host, and you can listen to this episode and more episodes of Health Watch online at kboo.org/healthwatch.
Hi, everyone. This is Dan Johnson, and you're listening to Radio Zine. And I have a very wonderful guest that is joining us by telephone today. Dr. Lauren Olson, MD, is a board-certified psychiatrist in practice for more than 40 years. A nationally recognized expert on mature gay men, he has spoken to groups across the country and appeared on ABC TV's Good Morning America, in addition to giving numerous national, local, and regional television, radio, and print interviews, and ours is included in that group. Dr. Olson is a regular blogger for Huffington Post and Psychology Today and lives in Iowa with his partner of 30 years, Doug, who became his husband in 2009 after the Iowa Supreme Court sanctioned same-sex marriage. He was previously married to his wife, Lynn, and is the proud father of two daughters and a grandfather of six. Well, that pretty well sums it up. You're just pretty much a human being, just like the rest of us.
Well, that's the way I like to think of myself, that's for sure, Dan.
Right. What I'd like to do is I'd like to get an idea from you, if you would, about this book. Why did you write it, and who was it intended for?
Well, I wrote it because I was about 40 when I began to question my sexuality. I had lived a perfectly what seemed to be normal heterosexual life up to that point and began to deal with some sort of unconscious feelings that I had buried for a long time, kept out of my conscious awareness. And as a physician would typically do, we go to the literature to try and find what's written. And when I went to the literature, I found that there really wasn't much written about older gay men going through this process. Most of the information about coming out was written about younger men. And in fact, the original work by Vivian Cass talked about going through about six stages, and that the final stage was 25, and I was about, I suppose, 35 when I was reading it, and I thought, well, I can't be gay then because I haven't figured this out before that time. And so I began to sort of believe that maybe there were some things that were different about coming out in midlife, and then I did some research to see if I could validate that hypothesis with other men who'd gone through a similar experience. And it then encouraged me, and there were people who made comments like, this book should have been written when I was coming out. So it gave me a lot of encouragement that there was a need for it. And then originally I had expected that the book would primarily be written and directed toward those men But as I progressed with it, then I began to realize that it was really important for not only those men, but the people who loved them, and also for therapists and clergy, and because I included things about gay history of growing up in the 40s and 50s in Nebraska, I thought it probably had some importance in terms of our gay heritage as well. So I made it a broader audience. This edition is the second edition, and I added into it a chapter on how to discover the opportunities that come with aging and to try and look at aging in a positive way.
One of the interesting things that I've found in this topic of older gay men and lesbians as well coming out is that I have this sense, and I'm not sure, there's nothing scientific I can put to it, but I have this feeling that the idea of older gay men coming to grips with their sexuality is not restricted to people in their 30s and 40s, but I know a lot of older folks like myself who came out in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now, in line with that, do you find that there are differences of why some people are able to do it younger in life while others still wait until they're older?
Yes, I think, Dan, there are a lot of reasons for that. For one thing, I don't know how old you are. I'm 74. But, you know, if we look back at that history of growing up in the 40s and 50s, and particularly in rural Nebraska, there were no reference points for anyone who was living openly as a gay man or woman. And, in fact, in my own experience, I didn't get exposed to anyone who was living openly gay until I was probably in my early 30s. Until that time, I lived in kind of a heterosexual bubble that was the world that I knew. And the only thing then that I had access to were the kinds of stereotypes that everybody else has as well about what gay people are.
And was that a bit of a shock to your system to discover that somebody else in this world besides you was gay?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it really was. You know, and that's part of the burden of it, is because you carry that around for a long time, believing that you're kind of the only person that's feeling that way. And, you're afraid to tell anybody, because if you say, I think I might be gay, automatically the assumption is that you are. And so you don't even have anyone that you feel that you can be comfortable sharing that with. And so it's a very lonely spot and causes a lot of emotional distress.
Usually when a person comes to you like that, how do you respond to them treatment-wise, if treatment, in fact, is needed?
Well, oftentimes it's a process of just trying to normalize it and just say, basically, you're not alone, that you're going through a painful time, that you're considering a decision, and in some ways it seems as if there's no good choice to make. Many of us have been married and have kids, and most of the men that I've met who have kids, that's a huge barrier to making a decision to come out, because most are pretty hands-on, invested fathers, and it's true for women as well, and not eager to give up that role in any way. And so that delays it a lot, I think, for many of us. There are also lots of people who grew up in cultures where there's just no acceptance of homosexuality in any way. And, of course, if you're in a very conservative religious tradition, then there are all the things related to this is a sin and an abomination, and therefore you're condemned to hell. So there are lots of reasons why people don't, and but in considering it, usually the losses are the ones that people focus on, and not the potential gains of the process of coming out.
Have you found in your study and your research if there is one common reason for people of any age why they come out?
I don't know that I can say that there's one common reason. I think that part of the there's like a pressure that builds up inside that becomes more and more painful. I've described it as an abscess. It's like this pain that's building up inside, and until the abscess is lanced, that pain just continues to grow. So that's one major thing, and it's at, in that pain that people often contemplate suicide as the only option that's available. So that's one thing. I think a number of us have also had an experience where we met someone that we fell in love with and found that there was a dimension of emotional and physical feelings that we didn't know that we could have. I know in my own personal experience, I thought my relationship with my wife was as good as it could be, but then when I fell in love with a man, I discovered a depth of emotion and physical intimacy that I didn't have with her, and I kind of felt like I had discovered what all the other boys were talking about, and I knew that it was going to be very difficult to try and keep that in check.
Now, you write in one part of your book about most people define gay as men who have sex with men, yet some mature men, rural men, working class men, and or men from conservative backgrounds who have sex with men don't identify as gay. Can you explain why they're unable or unwilling to identify as gay?
Well, I like the term men who have sex with men, or MSM, and the Centers for Disease Control uses that. The reason being that it defines behavior. It doesn't define identity. For me, identity is a very personal choice that we define our own identity, and we get into trouble when we try and define other people's identity, but we can define behaviors. And in one study in particular, there were a large study in New York City, largely working class and immigrant community. 10% of the men who were married were having sex with men, and 10% of the men who identified as heterosexual were having sex exclusively with men. So I think the issue of not being able to use the word gay and apply it to ourselves has to do with the fact that we have these internal stereotypes of what it means to be gay. And as long as you believe those, it's easy to say, well, I'm not like that, therefore I can't be gay. And the way that it's possible, I think, to deal with that is to be, again, to meet people who are gay that you admire, you respect, that you care about, and you recognize that there's a great diversity of people who are gay. And that helps to destroy all the stereotypes that we have of ourselves.
Isn't this MSN that you're talking, MSM, that you're talking about actually the same thing as sex on the down low?
I think it's similar to that, for sure. That, you know, the term down low really came out of the African-American community, and of course in that community it's still very difficult for people to come out, and it then took on a broader meaning after it were, I'm forgetting the name of the author, but he came on Oprah and talked about it there, and so people talked about it in more general terms, but it was particularly common use in the African American community. But yes, it is much the same.
Now, this next question I can relate to, because I grew up in the church and went to Bible college and studied to be a preacher, and then I realized that I was living two lives. And I know my story is not unusual, but it's really true. But I learned quickly through that experience just how horrible the evangelical church deals with gays and lesbians, in some cases on an extremely hostile basis. So how does a person still maintain their belief in God and in the doctrines of Christianity without losing that spiritual connection that they've had?
Well, I had a similar experience. I grew up as a Lutheran. I grew up in a town of about 1,000 people. Everybody looked alike and thought alike, and the majority were either Swedish or German. And the only diversity we had was one Jew in our community. And so there was this pattern of everybody believing kind of the same thing, and I kind of expected that I always would. And at that time, of course, the Lutheran Church was not open and affirming in any way, and it certainly has changed since that time. But it's very difficult to reconcile those two things. And so my own experience was to become disengaged from church for a long time. And then I felt a sense of needing to find that dimension again in my life. And I found a church, United Church of Christ, where they don't, one of their catchphrases is, we don't do dogma. There isn't a prescribed way to believe. That acceptance that I found there allowed me to become comfortable again in the community. And the church I belong to is really about 2,500 members, I think, and there's probably 250 gay and lesbian people who belong there. And it's never been an issue there. And it just seems to me that that there's such a contradiction or sometimes in the idea that God loves everybody and that's our job, you know, that we're supposed to love everybody, and yet we can't love gay people. That was never comfortable for me. I think, you know, one of the things I've talked about before is that maturity lends us some options in that, and we can begin to think through our value system and think whether or not the values and the beliefs that we had when we were younger are valid in our lives anymore, and perhaps deconstruct that value system and reconstruct one which is more comfortable and fitting for us. But it's very difficult if you maintain a commitment in a very rigid belief system, whether it's Muslim or evangelical Christian or some of the other faiths that say that this is an abomination and you're going to hell.
I want to remind our listeners right now, if I may, that you're listening to Radio Zine. My guest is Dr. Lauren Olson, MD, and a board-certified psychiatrist. And he is into the second printing Landing on his book finally out, and that's what we're discussing, and the issues of older gay men and women coming to grips with their sexual identity and moving forward with their lives from there. Have you noticed a difference in the way men come out as being gay as compared to women?
Well, that was one of the questions I had. When I wrote the book, and I made a comment in the book that I wasn't going to try and define what the process was like for women, that I thought it was up to women to do that for themselves. And yet I thought that there probably were similarities. So one of the endorsers of my book is a local attorney who was a high-profile lesbian, and I asked her to review the book. And she wrote a very nice review of it, saying that many of the kinds of conflicts and experiences that were common among the men I wrote in the book were the same as for women. So I think, you know, the idea of being committed to family values and the structure of a traditional family, those are very common for men and women.
I want to spend a few minutes now, if you don't mind, talking about something that's taking place as we speak, and it's this new alt-right political climate that we live in. And I really am concerned about how many of the LGBTQ advances that have taken place over the last 8 or 10 years may soon erode and slip back to some of their old conservative ways. What's your feeling about that, and what do you think needs to be done to maybe help prevent that?
Well, I share your concern about that. You know, I think we were lulled into a sense of complacency when marriage equality hit and thought, you know, our battle is over. And then things have begun to change. You know, I lived through, I don't remember much about it, but I read about all of the things that happened during the era of the Nazis, and then I was about 10 years old during McCarthyism and the purge of communists and gay people from the government. And so I've lived long enough to see those cycles and how they occur, and I find it very frightening about the things that are going on right now or potentially happening. I do think that a lot of the issues, particularly the most talked about one, is the bathroom issues. I think that in many ways that the alt-right has sort of let go of the idea of marriage equality now that it's the law of the land, and that this is their new cause to try and keep their base active and engaged. And I see it much more as a political strategy for them than it is related to really any religious belief in that. It is a scary time, I think, in so many of the things that I value, not just the laws related to the LGBT community, but so many of the things that I believe in and committed to are under threat right now. I think in terms of dealing with it, it's easy to hate people you don't know. And we can talk some about the in-group and the out-group psychology. There's a lot written about that. But, you know, the people that don't know us define us, and they define us on the basis of stereotypes. And until they really know who we are as human beings and understand what we're about and who we are, it's easy to be judgmental about us. So I think a lot of it has to do with letting people know how we're personally affected by some of these laws, that were very much threatened. But when we talk about it in terms of statistics and psychological studies and all of that, their eyes glaze over and they're just not interested in hearing that. But when you say this impacts my life or my loved one's life in this particular way, it changes the tone of the argument.
And if you had your, you know, if you had your druthers of what you would rather do, would you spend your time trying to prevent some of these issues eroding, or would you continue practicing psychiatry?
Well, I have the liberty as an older man of not having to work in the same way that I did before. I still work, and I love psychiatry. I practice now just a couple of days a week, and so I still enjoy that. But it does give me the freedom to be more engaged in advocacy for the, this particular cause. And, of course, a lot of what I'm interested in now is are these issues, as well as the issues of that relate to the older gay community.
Right.
And that's where I spend the majority of my free time.
Well, just as a final thought on that question, have you ever thought about offering your psychiatric services to the Commander-in-Chief?
I'm ethically bound not to analyze the someone I've never examined before, so I can't really comment on that. But I certainly have my opinions about it.
yeah, but it sure would be an interesting try, at least. Okay.
Yeah, I think he's getting to be analyzed pretty thoroughly in the press now, and I'm glad to see that. And I don't disagree with a lot of what's being said.
Okay. Again, my guest is Dr. Loren Olson, and he has gone into a second printing on his book, Finally Out. And if you have not read it yet, and I think it might be a good study. And let me ask you this. I guess it's because I'm so used to reading novels and short stories and poetry, you know, things that aren't going to alter the course of life. Is this book written as a study book, as a textbook? Where would you put it in its classification?
Dan, I think to respond to that, I'll tell you one of the things that I got back from someone who had read it. And it was a young man, and he said, "I thought I was going to read a book about you, but I read a book about me." And so that was really my goal. It was not to write something that was academic and sort of only of interest to people who were professionals or in the field. And so I tried to read it, to write it in a conversational tone, to make it accessible, and to avoid a lot of the psychiatric jargon and that sort of thing. So I want it to be available to students of psychology and human sexuality and to counselors and therapists who have to deal with some of these people who are suffering this. I want it to be available to the families of people who can read it. So I'm really hoping that it will have a broader audience than just an intellectually curious audience.
One final question, then we're going to have to go our ways. Tell me, what do you think we can do to remove the stigma of homosexuality so that generations of gay youth and young adults don't feel forced to live a life in the closet or on the down low?
I think the issue is that we have to be able to tell our stories Stories are what change people's minds, and that's why I put my own story in this instead of talking about it just in terms of the academic issues. I wanted to know that I wasn't just writing about this from a distance, but writing about it on the basis of having been through it myself and experiencing that pain. And I think when we talk about these things, that's what we need to share with other people.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Lauren Olson has been my guest on Radio Zine for another segment, another episode. I'm Dan Johnson. Thank you very much for listening. Join us again next time. Thank you, Doctor.
Good afternoon, or good morning. It's just about 30 seconds before 12 o'clock. Stay tuned for the noon news, which will be followed by Noontime Jamboree with your host, Wade Hockett.
And now the KBU News at Noon for Monday, April 10th, 2017, in local news. In an open letter released Friday, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court urged federal officials to declare courthouses off limits to immigration arrests. Chief Justice Thomas Ballmer wrote that immigration and customs enforcement raids at courthouses creates a chilling effect, not only on undocumented residents, but also on legal residents. The Chief Justice wrote that ICE's actions also deter appearances in court by legal residents who don't want to be subjected to hostile questioning based on their ethnicity. Ballmer joins U.S. Representatives Suzanne Bonamici and Earl Blumenauer in calling for courthouses to be deemed sensitive locations where ICE raids would be banned. Currently, schools, churches, hospitals, and funerals are labeled as sensitive locations under federal law. Although two of Oregon's representatives and the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court are in favor of banning ICE actions at courthouses, the law is unlikely to be passed by the Republican-controlled government in Washington, D.C. The White House and current U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions are also on record as being firmly against the ban when they responded critically